Welcome to Worlds Apart. For centuries, Central Asia has been both a coveted prize and a battleground in the great power rivalry, serving as a graveyard of empires, but also struggling to develop and prosper on its own terms. As the focal point in the battle for Eurasia moved westward to Ukraine with the devastating consequences for the latter, how do Central Asian nations manage their being at the crossroads of global politics? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Pravesh Gupta, Associate Fellow at the Vivekananda International Foundation in New Delhi. Dr. Gupta, it's a great honor for me, a great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me here.
Now, in the 20th century, it was sort of fashionable among historians and strategists to stress Central Asia critical's position. It was believed that whoever controls this vast region would have the resources and the military power to control the world. Does it still apply in this day and age, the sort of geostrategic significance of the region?
I think Central Asia still holds the geostrategic position in the region. But I think that era of the great game has gone. These countries are very well aware of their vulnerabilities as well as their strengths. So now what they are doing, they're trying to use their position to gain more and more from the different powers which have the intention to expand their influence in Central Asia.
Now, we are talking here about five stands: Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan, which were once part of the Soviet Union. And as you mentioned in many of your articles, they have always focused on pursuing a so-called multi-vector foreign policy. I mean, they are still doing that regardless of the war in Ukraine. But given that the distance between those various vectors has increased dramatically, how has their approach changed?
There has been a lot of propaganda since this conflict has started. So these countries have been in the limelight. It is mostly the Western agenda just to get something out of the Central Asian countries, though I have already mentioned in most of my articles that they follow that multi-vector foreign policy, and they are doing it even now. They haven't criticized Russia for whatever it is doing, and they haven't supported it. They have given the statements about having a peaceful resolution to the conflicts and all. But at the same time, what I have observed, that Central Asian countries' cooperation with Russia has deepened, in contrast to what Western perception or Western narrative have been going on, like Russia's decreasing influence in Central Asia. So I don't believe in that. I've seen that first time Russia, Uzbekistan have signed a gas deal. So this cooperation has deepened rather than Russian influence in Central Asia decreasing. Other countries like Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, they have been more vocal about expressing their interest when it comes to major powers involvement, whether it is Russia, whether it is China, whether it is West. They want these countries to focus on what the Central Asian countries want, more than what these countries want from the Central Asian.
Now, and yet at the same time, they continue building their ties with the West. Last year, we witnessed the first ever Central Asian Leaders Summit taking place in New York with U.S. President Joe Biden being present. You also wrote about the visit of the French President Macron to the region. So what do you think those countries are looking for in their relationship with the West, and what is the West hoping to achieve there?
See, I think the West has been pursuing its relation with the Central Asian countries since the collapse of Soviet Union, since 1991. Their primary agenda in the region was to, you know, take care of the security threats emanating from the Afghanistan especially. But the scenario has totally changed now. Now, the Central Asian countries, they don't want to discuss just the traditional security issues with the West. They want to discuss green energy. They want to discuss clean energy. They want to discuss climate change. They want to discuss trade and economic investment. Until unless the West understands that they should engage with the Central Asian countries on these lines, traditional security issues and discussions on that is not going to be beneficial for the West. The main agenda of the West is just to confront or contest Russian and Chinese engagement in Central Asia. Mm-hmm. And I think that is not going to... Central Asian countries, they understand that as they are pursuing their multi-vector foreign policy, they want to have relations with Russia, with China and with the West also. Mm-hmm. You cannot come to Central Asia and just to bash Russia and China.
I think even in Soviet times, the political or governing culture in Central Asia was notably different from the one in Ukraine. They were far more risk averse, I think. Do you think their perception of risk, their calculation of risk has changed in any way since?
I think they are now in a position to take risks. Mm-hmm. And one reason why they are now trying to take risks is because we see a positive regional integration wave in Central mm-hmm. Asia. You have seen a lot of C5+1 meetings mm-hmm. in recent years, in 2-3 years, we have seen a lot of meetings in that format. They are having a meeting with the US, with the Germany, with Russia, with China, with India. That shows that they are trying to showcase themselves as a single entity. They try not bringing the domestic and bilateral disputes into their broader regional framework.
Now, you mentioned this, there are many meetings within this new format of C5, right? Do those meetings actually lead to any substantive results? Because it's one thing to meet with Joe Biden and discuss whatever, but does this actually materialize in any projects on the ground?
I think yes, it is. I'll give you an example from India Central Asia Summit. Most of the proposals that have been made in the declaration signed in Delhi, that is called Delhi Declaration, most of the proposals have been already fulfilled. Mm-hmm. There were proposal to have a joint working group on Chabahar port. There were joint proposal for a joint working group on Afghanistan. The meeting of the National Security Advisors of India and Central Asia, that is already have been done. Mm-hmm. So I think this format has, because it is at the highest level, so most of the commitments made in the summit, it is being taken care of. Mm-hmm. And I think that has happened with the US Central Asia format also, because most of the thing that was promised in that summit, US is taking steps, though not on a larger scale, but they are taking interest to fulfill those commitments.
Now, you have written before that the focus of that meeting or the emphasis of that meeting shifted from, let's say, securities to something far more concrete, something that is of immediate interest. To those nations. But I think the biggest worry that both Russia and to some extent China have is that the United States would use those projects to, invest a little bit in those nations and then use them both as a tool and as a platform for big power rivalry. Do you think there's any appetite among those nations to be played like this, to, follow in the Ukrainian footsteps?
I don't think so, because the way or at the speed that United States follows when it comes to its engagement with the Central Asian countries, the speed has been very slow. Mm. Most of the projects that has been initiated under U.S. With U.S. United States support, those have been delayed for a very long time. On the contrary, we see what Chinese are doing, what Russia is doing, that is more prompt. Mm-hmm. And they have some strategic benefit for the Central Asian countries. Mm. So they know that until unless there is a, speedy implementation of projects with support of Russia and the US and the West, until then, I think their concrete interest in United States on Western policies not going to be that big.
Now, I don't know if you would agree with that, but I think both Russia and to some extent China have become somewhat more assertive in their foreign policy, but also at the same time more accommodating towards their neighbors. So they are far more careful about, you know, the diplomatic language that they use, about how their diplomatic moves can be interpreted. They're trying to show respect, to go out of their way to show public respect. Have you noticed a similar change on the American side? Because for the Americans, traditionally, you know, the demonstrative aspect of their policy is usually very important, and they tend to be arrogant at times. Have they changed their ways in order to court these middle or smaller nations?
I think it depends on what exactly the U.S. wants from Central Asia. We need to understand their main objective. And I think time to time it has changed. So their main objective when it comes to their involvement in Central Asia, that is just to counter Russia. Mm. And I think the Central Asian countries are very well aware of the fact, and they try to use that notion for their own benefit. Mm. They're trying to build good relations with the West or with the United States to get some investment.
They're being good traders because traditionally they have very good trading traditions. It's a land of many bazaars, many trading ways, and you know, those people usually pursue their, you know, not so much ideology but their own benefit. Are they? You seem to suggest that they're doing that.
This is my observation. I think I have seen that they are trying to utilize this situation mm-hmm. for their own benefit. Mm-hmm. And I think it is also proven to be a little positive for them, because now the region is more, it is working together. Mm-hmm. As five Central Asian countries, they represent themselves as a single entity.
Okay, well, Dr. Gupta, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
There's no end in sight over how you're going to continue to destroy the earth.
It's the case of the madness of the people.
I tried to go to the gym, but I'm certainly not ready to fight Russia.
This is all so absurd.
This is third world lunacy.
Brainwashing.
As Ursula von der Leyen likes to say, we have the tools.
Why don't we just start with stability and business deals?
What planet are you living on, man?
We have very good propaganda in our press here in Europe.
I think we don't know the aftermath.
Anytime that you're not allowed to ask questions, you should ask all of the questions.
The more questions asked, the better the answers will be.
To Worlds Apart with Pravesh Gupta, Associate Fellow at the Vivekananda International Foundation in New Delhi. Dr. Gupta, I asked you primarily about the United States from the Western side, but there was, at least historically, there has always been another influential Western player. I'm talking about Great Britain here. Does it play any role in the regional affairs these days? Because that influence tends to be, historically at least, tended to be less visible, but sometimes far more malicious, at least as far as Russia is concerned.
I think even the Great Britain or the British India, they didn't have any direct interest in Central Asia. Their main intention was to contain Russia. Mm-hmm. And when they saw that Russian expansion coming nearer to Afghan border, they were really worried. So they didn't care much about their involvement with the Central Asia. However, their main intention was to, contest Russian expansion.
How do you understand this historical rigidity? Because I think Russia has made efforts to mend its ties, not only with the West at large, but specifically so with Great Britain. I think Vladimir Putin's first visit as back in 2000 was to Great Britain because he wanted to bury this historical hatchet. And yet, for some reason, while you describe how adaptive Central Asian countries have been to the changing geopolitical landscape, the hostility towards Russia in the West seems to be very stable. Why?
I think it is because of the difference of ideologies. Mm. The problem with the West is whatever they say should be reiterated by the others. That is the superiority complex that Western countries has for a very, very long time. And they are also not able to absorb the other countries emerging as great powers, mm-hmm. economically, politically, or culturally as well. Mm-hmm. And I think with Russia, this has been even after so many efforts from the Russian side, they haven't been able to come into terms with the mm-hmm. Russian ideology. Mm-hmm. Because I think, like India, Russia is also a civilization state. And Western concept of civilization is universalism. Mm-hmm. They have a problem with the China as well. But they find ways to, find some negotiation process with the China. Mm-hmm. They are not able to have that sustained animosity with China because they are so much dependent on China. Mm-hmm. But that's not the case with Russia.
Now, you mentioned India as a civilization state, and India has its own interests in the region. I have read you writing in one of the articles that you believe that there is a sort of a synergetic overlap in cultural similarity between India and the region. What exactly do you mean? What are some of the cultural overlays there?
India and Central Asia are natural partners. For a very, very long time, archaeological evidence suggests that the Indus Valley civilization, which is almost 5,500 years old, they had contacts with the Oxus Valley civilization. And we have found the evidences from both sides. Okay. We have found the Oxus Valley objects in Indus Valley civilization. And similarly, we have found the Indus objects in Oxus Valley civilization. Though there has been lack of focus on archaeological research mm-hmm. When it comes to Central Asia.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you mentioned that the full potential of economic or even cultural, political ties between this region and your country has not been fully realized. What is standing in the way?
So the historical, cultural linkages that we have with the region, and that continued. It was continuous process until 1947 when India got partitioned and mm-hmm. Pakistan became an independent country. So connectivity became a major hurdle. Mm-hmm. And I think we have been trying a lot to reconnect with the Central Asian mm-hmm. countries. And because the goodwill that we have in Central Asia, it gives us a very favorable position in the region.
Yes, but at the same time, there are many other partners involved, the main of which is, of course, China, with which India has sometimes a somewhat tenuous relationship. How do you think is Indian approach different from that of China, specifically in this region?
Our engagement with the Central Asia cannot be seen with the prism of what other countries are doing. We never care.
But you do not exist in an isolated environment. I mean, everything affects everyone. So,
but see, this is the difference. Like the other countries, whether it is especially China, it has some sort of apprehensions when it comes to India's engagement with the Central Asian countries. On the contrary, India's engagement with Central Asia does not have any political agenda. We are natural partners and we want to reconnect with that region. Connectivity is a major challenge. We have been trying a lot to get back to the country. We have invested in Iranian port Chabahar, and we have been promoting the international North-South transport corridor. And I think within last decade, we have seen an upward trajectory in India-Central Asia relations. We didn't have any platform for the bilateral and multilateral discussion and debate. But in 4 or 5 years, we have seen India has dialogue and discussion with the Central Asian countries on multiple level. We started or we initiated the summit with the Central Asian countries before China. We did it in 2022, they did it in 2023. When 2022, when we announced that we'll have a summit with the Central Asian leaders, just before that, 4 or 5 days before that, China had one customary summit with the Central Asian. So it shows that they have some apprehensions with India. And why? Because we have so much goodwill in the region, and we are seen very positively.
What the region really wants is not just goodwill. They want firm investments. Does India have enough to offer in a practical sense?
I think yes. This is an area where we have a little problem. We haven't been able to utilize our full potential. And I think when it comes to India's investment in Central Asia, there are a lot of misconception in Indian business entities. Lack of awareness, I would say, because our relationship have been very slowly evolving. So the region has been under very misconceptual framework. Mm-hmm. The business entities were not very sure about having some potential investment potential in the Central Asian countries, but we have seen now that they are now very well entertained by the Central Asian business entities, and for that the government is also taking a lot of initiative. Okay. We have India Central Asia Business Council, we have business council on bilateral basis with Uzbekistan, with Kazakhstan. So we have been trying to improve our image as a economic partner of the Central Asian countries, and I think there are some positive indications, and I hope there will be more and more investment from India to Central Asian countries in future.
There is also one more transcontinental axis, and that is between Moscow and New Delhi, and certainly Central Asian countries would benefit from more trade, especially logistical projects between our big nations. But I think there is an opinion here in Russia that it would perhaps require a little bit more political will on the Indian side to, sort of be a little bit more open about its cooperation with Russia at this very difficult geopolitical moment. Do you see it coming from the Indian side, or do you see it as too risky perhaps at this point of time?
So all our connectivity initiative, whether it is North-South transport corridor or Chabahar port, so Iran serves as the transit country, and the problem that Iran has with the West, it has been hindering some developments on those projects. Though the Chabahar port was exempted from the Western sanctions, but the business or the investment or business entities, they have a lot of confusion with regard to using Chabahar port. And there was also one issue, we have 1 year contract with Iran to develop Chabahar port, and we wanted to have a long-term contract to make more investment in developing Chabahar port. And I think now we have already signed a 10-year agreement with Iran to develop Chabahar port. Mm-hmm. And that is a very good news, and it will give boost to Chabahar port. Mm-hmm. And once this Chabahar will be utilized to its full potential, I think this will also give boost to INSTs. Mm-hmm.
You touch upon a very interesting and potentially very risky thing, that is the interconnection between politics and economy, because there have been a lot of discussion about energy security, about diversification of supply routes from Central Asia, and for example, building additional pipelines for transporting its hydrocarbons. But do you think, given, for example, what happened with Nord Stream, given the political risks associated with energy projects, do you think there is any appetite for, let's say, building a new pipeline to bring energy sources to Europe?
Let's take the case of Turkmenistan. It has huge gas reserves, and I think it is one of the most, 90% of Turkmen gas goes to China. And Turkmenistan's dependence on Chinese revenues is too much. And they have been trying to diversify their export, but they do not have any option. They proposed that Trans-Caspian pipeline, where they will build one undersea pipeline to connect with the Azerbaijan so that they can transport their gas via Azerbaijan to Europe. There has been a lot of promotion on...
Well, there's been a lot of talk about it.
And there was also a lot of support from the United States. But ultimately, that project is going nowhere. So that is the reality. So they have to be, they're trying to diversify their exports, but because there are some structural issues and lack of financial resources, they haven't been able
to. But isn't it ultimately way too risky? I mean, given what happened to, you know, another pipeline, the gas pipeline bringing gas to Europe, if something like this could be eliminated, you know, on a political pretext or for unknown political reasons, don't you think that there are additional political risks associated with energy projects like this at this point?
I think yes, risks are there. But when it is about Western interests, if they want to have Central Asia's energy, then I think the risks will little depleted. And the precondition to that, those projects should be fructified.
Mm-hmm.
First, you will have those projects, then only you will be able to transport gas or oil.
Mm-hmm.
But if you only talk about having energy resources and exporting, importing and all, but on the ground, you have nothing.
Mm-hmm. Then I guess the point of my question is that in the past, there was a lot of talk about reliability of the supplier of energy sources, but what about the reliability of the buyer? Don't you think that is also an issue in this day and age? Because with China, for example, if China invests in your energy sources, you may like it, you may not like it, but you will trust that they will, you know, make sure that this project exists. Whereas with the West, can you be just as sure that, you know, the deal is a deal?
I think I fully agree to your point. There is no answer to that, yes. When it comes to reliability and the geographical proximity that this region has with the West, obviously there is a sense of fear, whether this project will work, whether this project will work or not, and is the West reliable in this sense or not?
Mm-hmm.
Because when it comes to West, they have their own precondition, they have their own way of thinking. So I don't think that when it comes to, especially in case of Central Asia and exporting their resources to the region, especially energy resources, the unreliability is surely a question that they need to ask.
Well, Dr. Gupta, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on World Apart.